The Guardian.
Before we get started with this edition of Politics Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code POLITICSWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anoushka Astana.
So I can confirm today that next week I will seek the authority of the Scottish Parliament to agree with the UK government the details of a Section 30 order.
Nicola Sturgeon has stunned Westminster with calls for a new Scottish independence referendum. With the government poised to pull the trigger on EU Article 50 talks, has the SNP forced Theresa May to choose between the single market and the union? We'll hear from the SNP's leader in Westminster, Angus Robertson.
I think we're going to have a debate across the full gamut of the issues of what kind of Scotland that we seek.
Plus, the government's budget is in disarray after its headline move to raise national insurance for the self-employed is scrapped.
We will bring forward further proposals, but we will not bring forward increases to NICs later in this Parliament.
But first, with Westminster gearing up for the triggering of Article 50, this week, Nicola Sturgeon dropped a political bombshell. The SNP would demand a new referendum before Scotland is dragged out of the EU and the single market.
I want the UK to get a good deal from the EU negotiations. That is clearly in Scotland's interests as well as in the interests of our friends in other parts of the UK. But I am far from alone in fearing a bad deal or indeed no deal. Nor am I alone in fearing that even a so-called good deal will be significantly inferior to membership of the single market and that it will set Scotland on a course that will not only damage our economy but change the very nature of the society and country that we are. The problem with doing nothing now is that by the time these fears are realised, it will be too late for Scotland to choose a different path before the damage is done.
Well, Theresa May came out straight away with a bucket of political cold water.
Instead of playing politics with the future of our country, the Scottish Government should focus on delivering good government and public services for the people of Scotland. Politics is not a game.
But the SNP plan to go ahead with a vote in the Scottish Parliament next week to authorise negotiations for a new referendum. And I sat down for an exclusive interview with the party's Westminster leader, Angus Robertson.
Your reason for being in politics is because you want independence. There's nothing that Theresa May could have done to have avoided this, is there?
I think there is, and the offer has been on the table from the Scottish Government now for months to reach a compromise agreement. It's the Scottish Government, the SNP, that has been proposing a compromise. So short of independence, a way in which the UK government could negotiate and secure Scotland's place in Europe, so membership of the European single market and a number, I mean, it's an 80-plus page document, so it's very detailed, but it is a compromise from the side of the SNP Scottish Government. And the UK government has gone through the motions of saying it will discuss and it will consider, and there have been meetings after meetings after meetings of the Joint Ministerial Committee, which involves the UK government and the Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish and Ireland authorities. And there has been literally no agreement from the UK government on any of the key issues of substance. Of course, the UK government signalled how important it is to get a deal that reflects the importance of the automotive industry to the northeast of England. Agreed, very important. Needs a deal that takes cognizance of how important the City of London is. Agreed, very important. Takes cognizance of the fact that the very particular challenges with Northern Ireland, having a land border with the Irish Republic, we're all agreed these are really important things. But if it's possible for the UK government to realise that these are really important, then why is it so difficult for Theresa May and her colleagues to understand that in Scotland, where we voted by 62% to remain in the European Union, and a Scottish government that has been unambiguous about the consequences of not reaching an agreement before the invoking of Article 50, I think only now the penny's dropped in Whitehall, because it certainly didn't drop before, that we in Scotland are extremely serious about protecting our place in Europe.
You want to be in the EU and outside of the UK. What currency would you foresee an independent Scotland using?
I think when we get to the stage of a referendum process proceeding, I think we're going to have a debate across the full gamut of the issues of what kind of Scotland that we seek. I think everybody understands that there was a detailed white paper in the run-up to the 2014 referendum, and you would be right to assume that there will be great detail about issues of the economy, issues of currency, issues of our relations with Europe and the rest of the world.
When might we see that?
And you will see that after the referendum process is initiated. I understand why you're asking the question. I know people are keen to know the answers to all of these things, but you'll also appreciate that we are very serious about getting from A to B, and we're very, very keen to protect Scotland's place in Europe. And where we are investing our attention at the present time, still, there may only be days, may only be weeks, but where all of our efforts are currently focused is trying to convince the UK government to come to a compromise agreement protecting Scotland's place in Europe. If that road runs out, and if we have to have that referendum, we will be turning our attention to making sure that we are making the case publicly, intellectually, and in every other way, so that people understand the choice when it comes to a referendum of a hard Tory Brexit Britain or a Scotland able to maintain its relations with the rest of Europe, reflecting the values of people in Scotland, which is frankly outward looking, is not narrow minded, and rejecting of refugees and of people who have come from other shores.
English mindset.
I think it is the mindset of the UK government. You're speaking to somebody, notwithstanding my accent. I am English by birth. I was born in Wimbledon. So have to be very cautious. Scotland is a country with people from many places. It's not about where we come from. It's about where we're going. And I think one of the things that has made a lot of people change their minds from no in 2014 to yes at the present time are people who are internationally minded, are people who do want to live in a country that welcomes visitors and welcomes people who choose to live in this country. And when people come seeking refuge, that we should offer them refuge too. And so this is about much, much more than just our relations with Europe. It's about the values of our country.
I was really interested to hear you say that all the effort right now goes into essentially trying to persuade Theresa May to offer you a differential deal. So whatever the long-term ambition you may have, right now is your preference in the single market while remaining in the UK rather than an independent Scotland?
If it's possible to get a deal with the UK government, the SNP has said that that is the priority that we're seeking to deliver. And that's why we have compromised on our core aim. We have said to the UK government, and for listeners of this podcast who are wanting to read it, please just Google Scotland's future, a Scottish government document. I think it's 82 pages long. It outlines the compromise on our core principle to be able to reach a deal with the UK government. Now, it seems to me on an issue so important, not just to Scotland, but the UK as a whole, if the UK government genuinely believes in a United Kingdom, the different nations and regions that we have here on these shores, you have to take the needs, interests, concerns and expectations of the different parts of the UK seriously. Because if not, the claims of a United Kingdom meaning something beyond the social union, which we all share and all value, frankly, is an empty one. And that's where the Tories, I think, are boxing themselves into a very dangerous corner for a party that claims to be a unionist party, where they're making it very, very difficult for people in Scotland who are not traditionally SNP voters to look to the future of a Tory-run Britain and accepting that as our best way forward, because it's not.
I know you are going to publish a white paper. I really look forward to reading that white paper. You must have thought about that relationship with the EU. Are you actively looking into the different options that there may be? So, for example, full membership, or maybe something like the Norway model?
We have great relations across Europe. We have members of the European Parliament. Scottish government ministers have been visiting different parts of the European Union. I've been visiting different parts of the EU. I'm just back from Brussels, where I was last Thursday. And of course, you look at how different European countries work. What seems to us to be critically important is that whether you are part of the EU 27 or whether you are part of EFTA, those are the European European Free Trade Association countries, Norway, Iceland, Switzerland and Liechtenstein, what's key amongst all of them is not just access to a single European market, but being part of a single market. And in parallel to that, having citizenship rights and the four key pillars that, all of this sits on top of, which is a free movement of people, labour and capital. And this is something which is fundamentally important. It's been totally lost in the debate that we hear in Westminster, which is we're caught between the headlights of a sort of UKIP-inspired anti-European agenda, which is a hangover from the referendum, and the Tories that have tried to tack right to make sure that they're not being outflanked, and Theresa May wanting to keep her backbenchers happy. Meanwhile, the rest of the UK, it goes without saying, the 48% who wanted to remain in the EU, and a whole lot of Leave voters who now feel let down because they're not getting their £350 million a week for the NHS or agriculture and fisheries powers. I think if people understood the difference between what they were promised in the Brexit referendum and the reality they're seeing now, I think in the cold light of day, a lot of people would be thinking differently. I know a lot of people in Scotland are looking aghast at the debate that's going on in the rest of the UK, because at least we have a different option. And if the UK government decides that we're all supposed to sit in the back of the Brexit bus, say absolutely nothing while Theresa May wants to drive us off this Brexit cliff, well then, I'm really sorry for those people who feel trapped in that bus. But in Scotland, we've got an option, which is to not be in that bus. And if that's the choice that we have to make, I'm confident that this is a choice that we will make.
And for your party, is this twist or bust? If you lose a second referendum, is it the kind of Quebec option like for you? You give up?
I've been in politics for a long time, so I cannot imagine that an SNP that's been around for more than 70 years, which has been the engine of Scottish constitutional change, will lose a referendum in these circumstances, point one. Point two, we're Democrats. If people make a decision that it's not what they want, then that'll be that. I would just observe that in 2014, people were being told in the referendum of Scottish independence that they had to vote no to remain within the EU. What an awful circumstance those voters now feel themselves to be in. They're now in danger of being taken out of the EU against their will, which is the material change of circumstance that we have in Scotland, and the reason why, if we have to have a referendum to protect our place, that's exactly what we'll do.
Two final quickfire questions. Does the campaign start on Friday? At your spring conference?
The campaign's already started. If people want to have a look at the website, it's there for people to sign up to. And I would encourage listeners of this podcast, supportive of a yes vote in Scotland, please to visit the Scottish referendum website, sign up and support.
And you, of course, would lose your job here in this lovely office in Westminster. I mean, that's part of the outcome of this. What would be next for you if you did win this referendum campaign?
Well, first off, I'm very confident that the good people of England will be able to govern themselves without Scottish MPs needing to be at Westminster. So I'd be happy to hand over my office. We'll be here so long as there's a job for us to do at Westminster. If we become a sovereign state, I'll be delighted to return to Scotland and contribute in any way that I can.
Angus Robertson, thank you very much. Well, joining me now are The Guardian columnist and leader writer Anne Perkins, Ewan McCaskill, who writes across The Guardian and Observer, and our Scotland editor, Severin Carroll. Sev, we've just heard from Angus Robertson, and he's claiming that the Prime Minister has days, even weeks, to still strike a deal with Scotland and to avert the referendum. But he's being cheeky, isn't he? He knows that they won't give him what he wants.
Yes, and there's also a suspicion too in Edinburgh that they really ought not to pretend that that is the case. I mean, there is this view that they need to show willing, even at this late stage, but actually everybody seems to know now that they're all digging trenches.
Why do you say that?
Well, in the sense that they now have a challenge in front of them. Nicola Sturgeon's thrown down the gauntlet. Theresa May now has to decide how she's going to respond. And the indications that we're getting is that Theresa May is going to respond to Nicola Sturgeon's demand for a very specific time frame for the referendum by saying, yes, you can have your referendum, but you can only have it after Brexit.
And Anne, why do you think that Downing Street are reacting in that way? Certainly the message we're getting from them is that Nicola Sturgeon's timetable was designed to make Theresa May want to say no.
Well, obviously, it plays it for Sturgeon and the Nationalists. It plays well to have May looking as if she's an obstacle. But at the same time, I think the last 24 hours has been really fascinating. I more and more get the feeling that this is a really complicated game of chess being played between two women who are very political in the way they approach it. And the whole way May is trying to frame this as a distraction from the real business. She tries to say that it's a distraction from what Nicola Sturgeon ought to be dealing with in Scotland, her own domestic problems. And of course, she also perhaps legitimately can say it's a distraction from the only thing she's really got headspace for at the moment, which is dealing with Brexit. I got the impression that the SNP has really moved quite a long way backwards from where Nicola Sturgeon was when she made her speech on Monday morning. There's a real sense that maybe she felt that she'd over-egged it. And I think May has emerged, notwithstanding other events since then, slightly stronger than might reasonably been expected at 11:30 on Monday.
And Ewan, one of the things that we were expecting over the weekend was that Article 50 was going to be triggered on Tuesday. Downing Street hadn't quashed that speculation. They then said, no, we always meant the end of the month, and actually we were always going to engage with the devolved administrations in this period. Do you believe them?
Not at all. I believe that they were going to trigger it on Tuesday. And Theresa May blinked first, standoff with Sturgeon. I mean, if you're the Tory Prime Minister, you're pulling out of Europe, but you don't want to go down in history as the Tory Prime Minister that presided over the breakup of the United Kingdom. I mean, that puts her into the category of Lord North losing America and David Cameron losing Europe.
And Sev, how likely is it to happen? You know, what's your money on at this early stage?
I think it's 95% certain that it will happen. I think the outcome is less certain. And, I mean, the opinion polls are putting it, you know, fairly squarely around 50-50. I think at this stage, the Scottish Government and the SNP have got the upper hand because they have the much larger organisation, they've got the money, and they've got the will and the impetus to push this hard. And eventually, for a lot of Scottish voters, this will become a contest between heart and head. But then, as things unfold, we've really got to see what the other factors are that have come into play. Instability in other parts of Europe, for instance, instability in other parts of the world, and perhaps also Theresa May will be more successful in developing a coherent and intelligent deal with the EU, which will allow the UK government to tell Scots that actually there will be a significant Brexit dividend, and that Brexit dividend will be more useful to accept than risking the incredibly difficult financial challenges of independence, which are not yet properly dealt with by the Scottish government. But the one thing that's in Nicola Sturgeon's favour at this time is that the opposition is divided. The opposition cannot agree on the alternative solution to Scottish independence. And with a very weak Labour leader, it's difficult to see quite who's going to lead, what's going to be the most effective way of challenging that.
Okay, and Ewan, on this point, who is going to make up the No campaign?
I mean, I agree absolutely with Sev. You know, it's 95% certain that's going to happen. And that's, I mean, there's a whole series of weaknesses in the Union's case that weren't there in 2014. I mean, Alistair Darling, last time round, was the frontman for unionism, backed at the last minute by Gordon Brown. I mean, I doubt if Alistair Darling will go through that again. And Gordon Brown coming back again. So if you haven't got that pairing, Theresa May is seen as a sort of pale version of Margaret Thatcher in Scotland. She'll be absolutely disastrous making the case for the union. Jeremy Corbyn isn't popular in Scotland either. Ruth Davidson is fairly popular, but not a big enough figure. It's hard to think of a single politician that's sort of big enough to make
the union. A celebrity, maybe?
But even that the celebrities, the Scots know celebrities fine to pull out as a bit of colour on a political occasion, but you're still looking for a heavyweight politician. The difference this time round as well, there's lots of differences. I mean, one, last time round, when Salmond called the referendum, the polls were standing at 28% for independence, and it ended up as 45. Now they're hovering between sort of 47 and 49. you're starting. That's your starting point. Then you've got 18 months of campaigning. And as Seb said, you've got Scottish Government behind it. Whitehall's going to be diverted by Brexit. You're going to have headlines every week about how terrible Brexit is.
But you're also going to get, as Seb hinted at just then, you're going to get mounting uncertainty and mounting anxiety. And that might, it seems to me, quite likely make people feel very anxious indeed about a further major change. I know there's an argument that says, you know, Trump supporters, for example, and indeed some Brexit supporters, felt they had nothing to lose by opting for the unknown. But I just wonder whether, in a, you know, with not just domestic uncertainty, UK-wide uncertainty, but Europe and global uncertainty, whether people will feel it's the right moment to take a big change.
This is a SNP argument that's Nicola Sturgeon's, but she says, you know, if you're sitting in Scotland and given the state of the Labour Party just now, you're looking at the Tories getting back in again in 2020, probably again in 2025. Plus, you've got the prospect of maybe rejoining the European Union. That's a pretty attractive ticket.
OK, and Theresa May, Sev, today in Prime Minister's Questions, responded on the issue of Scotland by trying to make this heartfelt, positive case about the Union. And I almost wondered if they'd sat down and had a conversation and said, last time we felt the emotions came out a bit too late, and from this time round, we're going to start with the positivity from the very beginning. Do you think that will be their strategy?
I think they'll probably put a heavier emphasis on that, but I think that the strongest suit that they have actually is going to be again on the economy. It's again going to be on the cohesiveness of having a single UK market. It's going to be on the cost of independence. But there is one other problem that we haven't identified yet, and that, of course, is for Nicola Sturgeon. She also has a conundrum facing her, because although support for independence at a headline level is nudging close to 50%, support for having a referendum before Brexit is only at around 35-38%. And in addition to that, a large cohort of pro-independence voters and SNP supporters in Scotland are also either highly critical of continued EU membership or still suspicious of the EU.
So this will be quite a difficult issue for them, presumably. What currency will Scotland
exactly,
have?
Exactly. There's all those things. The currency, central bank, how to deal with the debt, so on and so forth. But the thing is that Nicola Sturgeon may also end up having to go for a halfway house of joining the European free trade area rather than full EU membership, because she'll have the advantage of single market membership, which is the one thing that she stressed most heavily, and also greater freedom of movement. But that would allow Scotland to keep control over Scottish fisheries and Scottish farming, which are, you know, iconic parts of the policy landscape. But if she does that, then a lot of people are going to be asking, well, we're going to be paying all this money into Europe, but we're going to have to deal with all the nothing coming back from them, if you like. And the UK government can play on the immigration fear that's building up as well. Lots of Scots have this residual unhappiness about EU immigration. And Nicola Sturgeon hasn't quite yet tackled that. She's hoping that there's going to be lots of Labour and Liberal Democrat and even Tory voters who prefer being inside the European Union.
So are they not right, Seb, to say that actually Scottish people are open-armed when it comes to immigration?
I think that they are. There is less phobia towards immigrants in Scotland, but it's still a political issue up here. And I still think this can shape the way voters now respond to the independence question. It depends on the relationship with Europe and Sturgeon's proposals for immigration policy.
Okay, Ewan?
I agree with what Sev says, and especially still haven't resolved the dilemma of currency. But one of the biggest problems the SNP have, the turnout in 2014 was 85%. I think that's the highest turnout in British electoral history. Now, the problem the SNP had was they didn't get the young people who supported independence to come out, and they didn't get the working class people, especially in the Glasgow, East End of Glasgow and other parts of Glasgow. Now, I don't see why it should. How the SNP going to resolve that? How are they going to get young people out? They might support. How are they going to get those people who didn't bother coming out last time? It was a nice sunny day in Scotland last time round. The weather wasn't an excuse.
One of the arguments that the SNP have made is that it is people who might read The Guardian, Severin fans perhaps, internationalists, who voted no in 2014 because they believed the argument that if you voted yes, you might be leaving the EU. The SNP think that they have changed their minds. Do you believe that that might be the case?
I have to admit that when I heard Sturgeon's speech, I suddenly felt that, you know, maybe there was a, you know, a hint of sunshine on the horizon. Maybe there was a way that we could stay in Europe. So maybe it will be a persuasive case.
Well, you can follow all the referendum news on theguardian.com. Severin's going to leave us now, and it's time for a quick break.
Create a beautiful website or online store with an award-winning template from Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code POLITICSWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Well, back now with Ewan and Anne, and another big story today. Philip Hammond U-turning on a key budget pledge to raise Class 4 national insurance for the self-employed. Anne, how embarrassing is this?
It's deeply embarrassing. I mean, it's up there with all-time big budget U-turns. It really is. Less than 7 days, and he has been turned over partly by popular pressure through the media. It's got, you know, Mrs. May got her worst headlines in the Daily Mail that she's had since she became Prime Minister on this issue. But above all, at the hands of their own backbenchers. The 22 committee on Monday night, this is not going to fly. This illustrates that this government is completely in hock to its own backbenchers. And that is a dangerous place for it to be. And I think, although Phil Hammond's a very calm and accomplished performer in the House, he looked pretty uncomfortable as we watched him announce this, the details of this U-turn.
And Ewan, just on this, I mean, two things really. Arguably, the changes they were making to national insurance were progressive. And importantly, if not straight away, in the future, they will raise money that is desperately needed to plough into public services. Now, Theresa May says she's a new type of Tory, a red Tory, if you like. They've already backed down on representation of workers on boards. They're backing down on this. Do you think there's anything that they'll be able to push through past their backbenchers?
And there's a third one. Last year, Theresa May said she would tackle tax avoidance, and there's been absolutely no movement towards that whatsoever. I mean, I agree with you. I think this was a part of a progressive agenda, and she hasn't shifted on it.
But is the reason they've done this is twofold. They say that self-employed people are actually getting equivalents on pensions now, that they have access to the same public services, and that they are looking at ways to, you know, bring them together in terms of maternity and paternity needs. So should be paying a closer tax level to the employed. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. And, you know, we supported this measure and we think it is the right thing to do. And the absurdity of the climb down is that I would put money on whichever party wins the next election, they will do this. Politically, of course, it was really badly handled. You know, if you're going to break a manifesto pledge, even if you think you're not really and you've got your fingers crossed, you need to explain what you're doing. I think that there is an argument that says that maybe you need to get the kind of compensation in place, and you've only got pensions so far. Phil Hammond says he's going to do parental leave and benefits and some of the other benefits as well. And that's now the situation, the position. They say they'll bring in those extra entitlements, and that will make it more sensible to ease out the tax difference. But it's clearly got to be done. And the other thing, the other kind of emotional or cultural change that needs to happen is that particularly in the Tory party, they've got to recognise that the self-employed are not some placky band of sopratical entrepreneurs. The at least half and probably more are people who are made to be self-employed by exploitative de facto employers.
OK, and someone in Downing Street, Ewan, told me that Theresa May hadn't wanted to announce it in the budget. In fact, she had wanted to wait for Matthew Taylor to do a review into work to look at some of the issues Anne's talking about there and then announce it later. But pretty clear today, they're not going to break the manifesto promise. That means nothing before 2020.
Yeah. It looks like Downing Street is at odds with the Treasury. You know, there's been a sort of collision course, and you and the others have written about this. Watching Prime Minister's Question Time and the body language, it looked, when Theresa May was asked about it with Corbyn, she looked fairly comfortable because Corbyn made the mistake of talking about chaos in the government, and she was able to talk about chaos in the Labour Party. But when Angus Robertson raised it, then she certainly looked kind of stony-faced and not at all at ease, and deservedly so.
Yeah, I thought that Phil Hammond's worst moments were at the hands of people who are on the Labour backbenchers, who probably ought to be on the front bench, who very effectively made some good jokes at Hammond's expense. I mean, one of the things the current Labour front bench is really bad at is jokes, and you need jokes in the Commons, if not elsewhere. I mean, anger might well be justified, but it's much harder to listen to and much easier to rebut, oddly. I mean, the overall impression is that there is this weird disjunction where you have a government that is streets ahead in the polls, still has, although possibly less so later this week, a significant lead on economic competence, for example, and yet is actually completely controlled by a relatively small group of its own backbenchers. And these are not normal political circumstances.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Angus Robertson, Severin Carroll, Ewan McCaskill and Anne Perkins. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.